Are you a Smashburger king? Creating those crispy edges and the intense beefy flavor that puts fast food to shame? Thanks to Omaha Steaks, I never have to worry about whether I have high-quality proteins on hand. And they have so many options, handcrafted steaks, convenient comfort meals, and it's always excellent. Celebrate President's Day with the exceptional handcrafted flavor and convenience of Omaha Steaks. Get 50% off the world's best everyday protein. Go to omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their President's Day sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's 50% off at omahasteaks.com and an extra $35 off with promo code YUM at checkout. Go to https://omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide during their President's Day sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
Look at the screen. William Blix, the great red dragon, and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
Supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself. Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a very special episode of One Heat Minute Productions. I'm your host, Blake Howard. So today, I'm talking to a very talented and incredibly hardworking and busy and like ferociously obsessive person such as myself. You've heard some of his podcasts like Gene and Roger on The Ringer. You may have read his book, The Best Movie Year Ever. You've probably heard him a couple of times talk on this show. But he's... new novel, Hannibal Lecter Alive, is this amazing investigation not only into one of the most iconic pop culture characters in the last 100 years and maybe ever in literature, in popular literature, but his incredible creator and these weird and wonderful dissections that people and intersections between creative voices, being the original author Tom Harris or Thomas Harris and filmmakers or screen makers who intersect with him to make him or adapt him for whatever medium that they want. And really just the history of this character and the history of us. I'm of course talking to Brian Raftery. His book Hannibal Lecter Alive is brilliant. I absolutely smashed it. I consumed it like a meal. And I was so excited to talk to you about it. And I was so grateful when you sent me a copy. And I just wanted to talk to you all about it. Because as you know, my heart is so much about the Manhunter of it all. But
absolutely.
Did you scratch the surface with what you wanted to scratch with, particularly before we get to Hannibal, with Thomas Harris? Because that was one of the parts of your book and your research that I found so intriguing and like gave the book this energetic page turner energy that like this person who has had such a tremendous imprint on culture with some of his characters is such an elusive, unproductive guy in the nicest possible way, like as far as like output. But was that part of what kind of really got you going as, you know, your journalistic kind of like investigative mind was like this elusive guy that is at the center?
It was, yeah. I mean, because I knew the book would be about Hannibal Lecter, but I was so fascinated by Tom Harris and I knew very little about him. I mean, there, you know, what's so wild is that when you look at like contemporary authors, you know, authors of his generation, there's always this expectation, whether you're Stephen King or Elmore Leonard or Mario Puzo, like you do a lot of press. I mean, you do a lot of in-depth interviews. I just listened to an audiobook of this really good Elmore Leonard biography that came out last year, which I really recommend to people, especially if they're into the film adaptations. And Elmore Leonard would just have, you know, he wrote a gazillion books, and every time he did a book, He would just have reporters over to his house. Like, there's no, like, he was a very public figure and he liked that. He gave speeches. Tom Harris, as I found out as I was researching the book and doing reporting, his first novel came out in 1975, Black Sunday. In that time, which is now almost 51 years ago, basically, from what I can tell, he's given only three on the record extensive interviews with the press. One in 1975 for a book industry newsletter that's completely impossible to find. And thank God a wonderful librarian in New York City found a copy for me and scanned it, which I honestly can't believe still. And then in 2019, when he wrote a new book, he did a New York Times profile and a Hamptons public access show. So it's like, not only has he done sporadic press or like, it's like, it doesn't make sense what he's done. Like, he could have done a million podcast interviews when his last book came out. He could have been on The Tonight Show when Silence of the Lambs came out. You know what I mean? These were superstar novels. He sold 50 million books or something like that. So he was always kind of an object of fascination because it seems to me like he's had maybe the best life a popular author could have in the last 30, 40 years. I mean, Stephen King probably can't go anywhere without being stopped and recognized and maybe annoyed on his day. Tom Harris, I don't think even some of his biggest fans really know what he looks like. And he's not, you know, he made a lot of money and he traveled the world, traveled Europe. But what I was able to find out while doing the research of the book is I really was able to dig into what little of his past is out there. And thankfully, because he was a journalist and he worked for newspapers in the 60s, some of his articles were out there. Some of those articles were slightly autobiographical. You know, one of my favorite finds was, you know, and I spent 2 years researching this book trying to find any nugget of Tom Harris I could, was he was a newspaper reporter in Waco, and I read a bunch of his stories. And one day, randomly, just going through newspapers.com, I found the newspaper he worked for took out a full-page ad spotlighting some of its staffers. And there's a photo of young Tom Harris I'd never seen before. I mean, I don't think anyone has seen it what year it ran. So, like, stuff like that, which in the grand scheme of things is such a minimal bit of information, for a project like this where I needed every scrap of intel I could, that was just, like, gold to me. And, you know, the other obstacle was not only will Tom Harris not talk, but he's in his 80s, like I said, and, you know, a lot of his contemporaries have passed on. A lot of people I was trying to interview I reached out to, they passed away in the last 5 or 10 years. You know, his agent passed away. I think many of his former editors and colleagues at the various newspapers and the AP where he worked passed away. So that was a real challenge, but I was really happy with what I found out about him, and I admire him. And I also, I can't lie, at a certain point halfway through, I'm like, I'm writing about an incredibly elusive serial killer with, let's say, very global tastes and a love of the good life. And meanwhile, the guy who created him, I don't want to say Tom Harris is a cannibalistic serial killer. I'm not implying that. I don't know what the legal disclaimers are needed for your podcast, but, you know, he's created by this guy who has similar interests, has a similar disposition, and who disappears for just as long. So
who loves contributing occasionally. Yeah. To the odd journal or article or favor or something.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Who loves painting, who loves Italy, who loves, it's like when I was reading it, and I just want to touch on something you said, because I think maybe it's more guys like you and I, which is whenever you see, you know, hugely wealthy people that decide that, for example, they want to stay on Twitter and have arguments.
Right.
Just on a daily basis. And I'm not saying having opinions and being an integrity and standing behind them. I mean having shitbag arguments about dumb things on Twitter with...
Right, 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 right.
And I just want to tell everyone, if I ever came into Thomas Harris money, you would never hear a peep from me again.
He's never stepped in it. There's never been a Tom Harris notes apology on Twitter. He's never, I mean, I'm not even entirely sure where he lives at this point. And honestly, a lot of people I talked to who worked with him closely for a couple of years don't know either. I mean, I think he's just kind of lived his life. And the other thing that I was kind of interested about Tom Harris, and I think you of all people would appreciate this, is that he did remind me a lot in some ways of Michael Mann in two ways. One is that, much like Michael Mann, Tom Harris loves the research. He wants to know how, if he's going to show, you know, a particular device in a scene, Tom Harris is going to write a description of something. He's going to know how it works. But I also think Tom Harris and Michael Mann are also interesting because in certain ways, you and I are like this, and a lot of people get obsessed with certain authors or filmmakers, is you're always trying to find the clues to that creator in their work. And I do think Tom Harris, there is some of that. There is, I mean, again, he's not a cannibal, as far as I know, but there are similarities to him, and you can see parts of his life. I mean, I joke about this in the book, but when you read the novel Hannibal, which is all about, Hannibal Lecter in Florence for a large section of it, it's so clear, and Tom Harris spent part of the 90s in Florence. It's so clear that like Tom Harris had just as much fun in Florence as Hannibal Lecter did, like, because the details are so ornate of what it's like to live the good life in Florence when you're really wealthy. So I think, I do think that, again, these books don't function as autobiography, but I think in some ways you don't need Tom Harris to give an interview because part of him's right there in the work, it's in the text, as the kids say,
Yeah, it's and this book obviously charts everything we know about Hannibal Lecter, and what I loved, and we will get more to the, I guess, the iconic Hannibal, the emergence of him outside of even, and as much as I love Manhunter and as much as I love Cox as Hannibal and as much as I think that that text is a brilliant adaptation of Red Dragon, even though that at the last moment Dino De Laurentiis's fear in the crushing failure of Year of the Dragon made them change the title, I think that what was so cool about your book is the recognition that universally, and I try and tell folks this when we just are talking about Silence of the Lambs in passing, I'm always like, have you read Red Dragon? It's just, I'm like, have you read it? I go, there might not be a better, tighter, punchier, like exciting, thrilling, kind of in the least derogatory way, like airport novel you could ever read in your life. Like it's the most entertaining, and it goes beyond just purely entertaining and page turning in that every name, the sentence economy, the detail, it's unbelievable. And I still to this day, like as much as I love Silence of the Lambs and have read that book and think it's equally brilliant, I've gone back to Red Dragon so many times as a book, and it just is such a brilliant thing. And I think that that was just such an amazing thing to hear in your research, not only as you were talking about leading up to adaptations and the post Black Sunday of it all, and really for me illuminating just how big Black Sunday was as a novel, because having no idea about any of that, even though I've seen the film and obviously know him, but hearing about the different people who praised Red Dragon and continued to call it like one of the great American novels for the longest time, it was such a cool part of the book to learn and to be illuminated by.
Well, I mean, one thing that's really interesting to me, and this is a little bit of a tangent, is that one of our great kind of cultural critics is Stephen King. Like, you could really, he's done lots of book reviews. He obviously wrote a book on horror, which I thought was great. I don't always agree with his opinions, but how he, his sense of why a particular movie, a horror movie or a horror book or a story connects with an audience at a time and the machinations of horror, Stephen King is great at that. And so he wrote basically the first big review of Red Dragon in the, I think it was in the Washington Post in 1981. And it is not only a rave, but it is completely 100% spot on about how good the book. I mean, it's like not only about how good the book is in terms of its prose, but also why it's hitting at that moment, at the end of the 70s when there's all these quote unquote celebrity serial killers and there's all this crime going up and people are getting this anxiety, which I was around for, but I was like 4 or 5, so I don't remember, I don't remember the anxiety at the time. But there'd been some high profile assassinations and there'd been these, again, these really big serial killers in the late 70s. And Stephen King is like, this book captures that anxiety right now. And I think he uses a great term to describe the book, which I think he's something like, it's like reading Red Dragon is like stepping into a limousine where everything works and everything moves perfectly. You're like, that is what his book. And I also say, have you read, had a chance to read Black Sunday yet?
No, I haven't.
You'll love it. It's great.
Because like I have all, I even have Kari Moore. I always forget the name.
Kari Mora.
I've got Kari Moore. I've got like all the books on my shelves, and I was just looking through just before going like, where is my copy? Spread around different parts of the house, shelves and things like, where is that copy of Silence of the Lambs? I don't have Black Sunday, but
You'll love it.
my dear friend, who's an author as well, Maria Lewis, and I, she's such a Thomas Harris fan. She's like, Black Sunday. She's like, the movie is great. She's like, but the novel is great. I'm like,
It's really
okay.
great. And you can see all the writing that would become part of Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. Like, again, like the research that he puts into certain elements, the economy of writing. And speaking of economy, what's so amazing about Red Dragon is that one thing that's kind of surprised me is I was looking at like old hardcover editions of it. I assume that Hannibal Lecter would have been like mentioned in the jacket copy. He's in the book for like 12 pages. He's barely
He's
in the
barely in
book.
it. He's barely in it.
And he wasn't even, he, when I went back and read, I'm like, well, surely the reviews will mention it. And like, even very few of the reviews of Red Dragon 1981 bother to mention Hannibal Lecter. I think he became much bigger than Harris could have imagined, which is why he got a bigger role in the rollout for the Silence of the Lambs book. But yeah, I mean, Black Sunday and Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, those first three novels are so tight and so precise and so really enthralling that I think it bums me out a little bit that Tom Harris's novel, you know, Hannibal and Hannibal Rising, where he lost a little bit of a, there's still some good stuff in those books. I think some people kind of started writing him off at that point, and it bums me out because his first three books are so good. And I do sometimes wish he'd applied the same economy to Hannibal, which is like a great book in there somewhere. That doesn't
Yes.
always fully hang together for me. But I love his writing, and that's, you know, if this book that I did encourages people to seek out those early Harris novels or reread them, I'd be delighted because they're, Black Sunday is so much fun. It's such a great, it's a terrorist thriller, and it moves like that. You know, it's very few action thriller novels that I think work on that level.
And it's a Frankenheimer adaptation as well. Like talking about who has adapted him as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I know.
It's
I know.
like.
And I wish I loved that. There's parts of that movie I really like. I think the problem is I rewatched the movie having just reread the book, and it was so fresh in my mind. And the movie, despite being 2 hours, feels much slower than a 300-page book to me. And also, Robert Shaw's accent's a little, I mean, the accents are a little iffy in that movie. But I do love Bruce Dern. Like, Bruce Dern is great in it. And there's some parts that really have that fun, pulpy, mechanical Frankenheimer feel that are great. I actually think someone should really, I mean, it might be a little too edgy to make that movie now, but I do think that is a great story to be remade in 2026. It's very, very apt to our times.
I agree. I think it's brilliant. But the thing is, Brian, as you know and can appreciate from all of your research into movies, is like, who's going to have the balls? Like a John Frankenheimer to go to the NFL and go, I would like to shoot
Oh yeah.
at a live Super Bowl. And then we'll do the crash and the nonsense, but we want to just be there,
Yeah.
guerrilla style, and shoot like Robert Shaw just bombing around the crowd. Like
Yeah.
that movie,
It's
like
not gonna happen.
I rewound it like 10 times the first time I saw it. I got it
Yeah.
on Blu-ray from Imprint and I kept rewinding. I'm like, this can't be fake.
No, it's good. That the chase scene is great. I mean, some of the effects you do see them in one or two shots, and you're like,
Yes.
oh, that is not a real blimp. But that is kind of a remarkable, like again, anything with crowd scenes like that from the 70s, 80s, or 90s, I'm always in awe of just like that's 70,000 people or whatever, not 70, but you know, that's at least 10,000 people when they're shooting that angle or 5,000 people,
Yeah,
however they had to wrangle it, yeah.
when you know, it's even like early 2000s with Gladiator, it's like that's not 50,000 people, but it's about 5,000 people in Morocco just
Did I don't know if I told you this. Maybe
moving
I
around.
mentioned this is a side story, but the first time I was ever on a movie set was in a sports terrorism movie, which is that as a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh, maybe as a sophomore, I got to spend a night on the set of Sudden Death with Jean-Claude Van Damme
I know it's
in the
so.
hockey arena. Have you ever seen it?
I've seen it a million times. I
Oh yeah, it's
love
great.
Sudden
I love
Death.
that movie.
I
I love
love
that
it.
movie. Yeah, and they gave us all, we were sitting in the Pittsburgh arena. They gave us all two free hot dogs and a soda. But the rest of what's wild is like the rest of the stadium was all cardboard cutouts. I think they were cardboard cutouts of maybe Shaquille O'Neal, and all of them had splashes of paint on them. I'd love if someone who hears this can tell me if I'm right. I believe it was Shaquille O'Neal. And we sat there for like an hour and a half. We're watching these boring hockey scenes. And you know, we get our free soda and hot dogs and whatever. I was 17 years old. I'm on the set of a movie. I was losing my mind. I could not believe I was on the set of a movie. And toward the end, they go, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're happy to introduce Jean-Claude Van Damme." And we're all like, "What? Like Jean-Claude Van Damme stunt double?" We're like, "Oh my God, Jean-Claude! We're not going to see Jean-Claude Van Damme." But oh yeah, Sudden Death, perfect movie. I love that movie, man.
It's
That
so
is
great. Do
when
I have it?
Powers Booth actually says the word "sudden death," that is movie heaven for me. Yeah.
Die Hard in an ice rink. That's so funny. It was like my friend recently, Alexi, saw it for the first time. It's like, oh my God, dude. He had a freak out about how good it was. And I'm like, yeah, I've seen Sudden Death like a million times. It's so
Oh yeah,
great.
those Van Damme movies are fantastic.
They really are. So what's so good is you obviously go so deep, and someone who is a person like me who watches went into Michael Mann's Manhunter, you know, a scene at a time with our podcast, Manhunter. Like, so much of that particular corridor fascinated me in your book, because some of it was really familiar, but some of it was really new. Yeah. And I think what you said before about, like, the Harris's practice reflecting the text is, like, especially in those first three novels, you've got his whole life as a journalist that leads up to his ability to orchestrate that novel, pulling things from live news stories, pulling things from different, you know, immersions and excursions off to different, you know, prisons and different crime scenes and different, you know, horrific attacks that he had to cover. But then in both Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, like, these, you're finding out about these core relationships, or you at least charting these core relationships that he has on his research journey, both as a kind of auditor of John, all things John Douglas, and then secondly, meeting that great real life FBI agent who, like, he worked with to help orchestrate and think about all of the details on Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
Hearing how he did that, again, I think you're so right. It's like, you're trying to find the clues, but the clues are the work. Like, the clues are the work that he does to get the detail, to make it feel so real and authentic. And when they validate that authenticity and go, well, yeah, that, all of that, the framing, all of that structure, there's something that feels inherently true about it. And then there's obviously the fantastical and crazy and, you know, other things that we find out in the novels. But that's what I loved, that transition, watching him going from, like, behavioral profiling is a skill plus the FBI, and watching him just sort of, like, quietly navigate through the dark walls of all of this kind of thing. He's almost like Hannibal from the TV series, you know, just like,
I know,
an intimate relationship with the FBI and then going off and doing this stuff. But he does that. And I found that really interesting as you were charting it through the book, like how his research and his immersion and his interviews and his listening became so critical to how he eventually orchestrated his stories.
Well, I knew, you know, again, I knew I wasn't going to get Tom Harris. And early on, there was a name that I was obsessed with, because I saw a woman named Athena Varunas thanked, I think, in Hannibal and Silence of the Lambs. And his, you know, he doesn't have a big thank. Tom Harris doesn't put a big acknowledgments list. So, you know, he thanks John Douglas at one point, I think. So anyone on that list, I was trying to find. And then I went to Jonathan Demme's archives at the University of Michigan, which was amazing, where they had like 13.
I have a whole question about the Demme archives.
I could talk about that forever. It's one of the highlights of my life. But I found a fax from Tom Harris, again, mentioning this woman, Athena Varunas. And I was like, okay. And I knew she was an FBI agent at that point. And I found her. And Tom Harris spoke with a couple of different female FBI agents while researching the Silence of the Lambs. But I finally found Athena Varunas, and I emailed her and I said, hey, would you be willing to talk? And not only did we talk on the phone, our first conversation was an hour and 58 minutes. She was like, I have a little bit of time. And I was like, okay, well, and we talked at length. She then sent me a USB drive with a lot of her notes from her times meeting with Tom Harris, which is remarkable. And I can only use like 20% of it, but she has incredibly sharp recall. And she is very, I mean, there are a number of women, like I said, that he spoke with, maybe not a huge number. I know at least three agents that Tom Harris spoke with. There may be more female agents, but Athena Varunas is definitely a huge part of Clarice Starling. So finding her and talking to her and having photos of her, and I mean, stuff like that is just like, you're praying this person writes back to you or calls you back when you're doing stuff like this. And it, you know, you do reported projects. Sometimes one person saying yes, it makes the entire difference of your entire book. And I don't think I'm happy with the book. I would not be as happy with it if I had not found Athena Varunas and some of these other FBI people to talk to me, because they're fascinating. And they played a huge role in the creation of these books and later these characters.
What you just said is so pertinent to an upcoming project, is because I am about to embark on The Insider. So it's 20 episodes on Michael Mann's The Insider, a scene at a time. And I got connected with the real Lowell Bergman.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah.
And we had originally planned for a 30-minute discussion, and 2 hours and like 45 minutes later, I had Lowell Bergman. And it was like,
that's great. Oh,
that's a crazy thing. And then very recently, it looks like I might get the great co-writer, Eric Roth. And it's just like a couple of things have happened. I'm like, oh, this changes
Yeah.
This changes the project. Like and I can so understand that for you. But yeah, Athena Faruna's when he was talking about that, and especially her describing his listening.
Yeah.
That for someone who you say has their own very wild recall, and as an agent, I would imagine, and sometimes as a journalist or whatever that capacity, I like taking voracious notes. I don't use all of them all the time, but I try and get things down, you know, moments of clarity, those things you're just like trying to etch them down so that you don't forget them when you're orchestrating what you're eventually writing or talking about
in
the podcast. But to hear her praise his recall, like about, oh, he got everything.
Well, yeah.
He was really, he listened to everything I was saying.
He listened. And it's interesting because he's a Southern gentleman. When you watch the one, you know, again, the only recorded interview with him really is this extensive public access interview he did in 2019. And he also narrated Hannibal. Other than that, you don't really hear him speaking much, but he's got a very gentle, soft voice. And the few people who spoke with him, I think they were always surprised at how much he was listening, because he wasn't aggressive with questions. He wasn't like, all right, what happened here? He was just sort of slowly picking up details, kind of absorb them, which is, and that's interesting because he was a newspaper writer, and you are kind of trained as a newspaper writer to be really like, fact, bullet points, you know, kind of sometimes to be very aggressive to get information. So he clearly had a demeanor that set people at ease. Once again, sometimes Hannibal Lecter could have that same demeanor. I'm not comparing them. I'm just saying, in order to write a character who knows how to get people to say things that maybe they didn't want to volunteer or weren't expecting to volunteer, you do need to have some of that skill yourself to elicit those kind of responses. So again, another way that Harris and Lecter, again, they're not the same, but they line up, you know?
Yeah, that's what I think at the heart of your novel, you're not as glib as to say that joke or to say that, but it's like when you're accounting for his post-Silence of the Lambs, like, you know, as he deserved, right? The most popular piece of popular culture, and then influencing the biggest film, one of the biggest films of the year, and then one of the most critically lauded films of all time.
Yeah.
With Demi. And hearing about like living it up in Florence, painting, perfumes, you know, wine. I'm just like, this is the beginning of Hannibal. I was like almost talking to you as you were writing. I'm like, Brian, this is the beginning of Hannibal. And you're like, so it's interesting with, I'm like, yeah, Brian gets, he knows what he's doing in this.
I mean, Harris studied cooking in France. I mean, he's a chef. I mean, he liked to entertain guests in the Hamptons, which is something Hannibal Lecter would do if Hannibal Lecter had a spot in the Hamptons, you know?
I'm sure Hannibal did.
Yeah, probably, yeah. He's not the late great. Canonically, he's still alive, despite what America's president might think. Yeah.
Oh, God. The brilliant thing, obviously, so cataloging his life, like, amazing. Just to bookend, you know, you then sort of do this beautiful sort of cascade of how the latter part of his career, they were trying to sort of franchise and own his Hannibal and him trying to then be more directly involved with the films. And I think if we learn anything from your book, I think you're really, really fair and kind, and we should be fair to him as a creator, is that like they were just overworking him to the bone, and he didn't have the time for his ideas to gestate in the same ways with the pressure of the timing to make things happen that he had in those later books. And then, you know, Kari Mora is, I know lots of folks don't love it, but I have a great time with that novel. I think it's much more reminiscent of his early novels as far as like quality and as far as prose and thinking time. It doesn't feel as rushed, but I'm dying to ask you, you talk in the book about getting into the Jonathan Demme archives when you were deep into your research of how the Silence of the Lambs adaptation came around. And there was always rumors, which particularly interested me because of the De Laurentiis company, of like when the rights came, who had the rights.
Right.
There's always rumors that we used to get, and I always used to take them with a grain of salt, of like Michael Mann was offered Silence of the Lambs before Demme and turned it down and all these sorts of things. And I was really interested in your reporting of it and your reading of it, because like, I was like, I'm sure Brian will get to that. But forgetting all of that nonsense, tell me about just getting into the Demme archives and being able to dig into everything that is, again, one of the greatest American movies ever made, Silence of the Lambs and Jonathan Demme.
It was It genuinely was a personal and professional highlight. I have not done a lot of work with archives, even my reporting. I've always either talked to people or traveled somewhere or gone through archival materials or old newspaper articles. And for this book, I went to Elon University, North Carolina, where Ken Utt, who produced Silence of the Lambs, has his archives. So I started there, and he did a lot of great stuff. Kenneth Utt also was like a really fascinating guy who produced, I think he produced like the French Connection and stuff. So there's also like fun things like this is John. At one point I found like John Travolta's like contract for like Saturday Night Fever or something like something from Saturday Night Fever. So there's so much great stuff in these archives, but for the Demi collection was amazing because it's at the University of Michigan, which has Orson Welles papers. It has Robert Altman's papers. It has John Sayles, I believe. I think Nancy Sacova. It has all these great filmmakers' papers. And the way I sold the book to Simon & Schuster was we really liked the idea. And my editor was like, why don't you find out how much material is in this archive of Silence of the Lambs, of the Demi archive? And I had this great Zoom with this guy, Phil, one of a handful of incredibly helpful librarians who helped me with this book. And he was basically like, yeah, we've got 12 or 13 boxes here. And, you know, no one's really gone through them. And I was just like, can I get on a plane like tomorrow? Like, and I didn't go the next day, but I spent a week out there and I spent basically all day, 5 days in a row, I would open a box. I had a portable scanner, and there was so much material. I mean, there was everything from hundreds of, contact sheets of behind the scenes photos, none of which I'd ever seen. I mean, Demi had like a photographer on set, I think every single day, a really high end photographer. There's memos from the FBI. There's Anthony Hopkins' contract. There's Jodie Foster's contract. There's publicity materials that never materialized digitally anyway whatsoever. There's so much great stuff. And so I would just go in every day and just, like I said, set up a scanner and not even really even read stuff in depth because I was going to take it all back with me and just be like, oh, transcript of Anthony Hopkins on a morning zoo radio show in 1991. I need all this. Scan, scan, scan. Go through it like, oh, giant box of photos of Jodie Foster posing with FBI agents. Like, need that. Just take a picture, scan it all in. And it was only, and then I went through it day after day for the next 2 or 3 months, just going through every single item. And it was amazing. There's faxes from Tom Harris. There's, you know, Tom Harris would draw little cartoons and sometimes draw them to John, send them to John and Demi. It was so invaluable. And halfway through, I was like, I have so many friends who are movie, like hardcore movie nerds. And I want them for this. Like, you know, I don't know if you've ever had a friend who's had like a religious conversion and they're kind of like, but I want you for this. I want you to enjoy this too. It's like, for me, I'm like, I want all of my movie loving friends to have the experience of being obsessed with a movie for decades. And then all of a sudden someone opens the door, puts a bunch of boxes on the table and says, well, here's everything you've ever wondered, hidden in here, go for it. It was so much fun. Like I think I had to stop every day at 4 or 5 because of the library hours. And I was like buzzing going back to my hotel room. Like I was just sitting there by myself, like looking at faxes on my phone from Tom Harris. It was an amazing experience. I hope you get to do that someday with a movie you love.
It sounds like an absolute dream. And especially because, you know, a couple of times in my life, I've had the pleasure of like, you know, getting a PDF of like 100 behind the scenes photos of Heat.
Yeah.
90% of them that I know never existed, you know, yeah. I'm sure that I'm the first person since people who've actually seen some of these that they come out.
Yeah.
Because when I see one pop up online, it's because it comes from a published source. But like I have a PDF that has all those photos. So when
I'm like,
oh, wow, like that's incredible. So like you do see that, but you seeing that across Silence was great. And I loved in your book, although they didn't have like a really tight connection, as in like Harris and Demi, like they weren't, you know, the author wasn't on the set.
No.
You know, Ted Talley had done the adaptation and, you know, Demi and his incredible crew were there for it. The actors were super game. They'd had the agreements from the FBI to shoot things in certain places and have the requisite cooperation and all those things. But what was really cool is kind of the way that you chart like Harris not wanting to be involved and being very happy with how the novel is going, but then like in his way being incredibly proud of what Demi does, even though you can't quite like pin down what that is, but like it kind of was this cyclical thing of like he got this you know, that was kind of the peak and the absolute peak of his popularity, people going back and buying Red Dragon, people buying the book again, you know, all those sorts of things. And it makes this huge movie that wins all these awards and like really fundamentally shifts Hollywood in a really positive direction. And Demi, you know, is the guy that gets his Oscar, and now that's kind of, he's lauded for the rest of his career and can be appreciated appropriately for his incredible art. But
yeah,
I loved that in this book that you were able to sort of chart that, because Harris was so kind of admirable. He was like, no, the movie is its thing. The movie is remixing my work. He had a really super healthy relationship about what his work was versus what the movie's work was. And I just loved that he had that. And then he was also able to, like, you know, be really encouraging to the people who are adapting his work, going like, wow, sounds like people love it. Yeah. Like, thank you. You know, like that, that's such a cool level of humility that he seemed to have, which again made me admire him even more.
Well, you know, I mean, I mentioned this in the book, but, you know, multiple people who knew Harris told me he did not like Manhunter.
Yes.
You know, in specifics, I don't know why. I'm sure changing the ending of the novel did not stick well with him. And, in you know, it became clear in later years that he did not love the Hannibal adaptation changing the ending of that book.
Yeah.
You know, he had this experience with Hannibal Rising, which you alluded to, where he wrote the screenplay and the novel at the same time, which is just an absolute, you know, anyone in Hollywood or publishing would say, like, don't do that. It's too much. And
Who works, that's like two incredibly demanding full-time jobs that are at least 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And every day.
And one requires you having bosses, really. I mean, when you're writing a screenplay, you have to collaborate. I don't think Tom Harris.
You have to have meetings and you have to take notes and you've got to do
a lot of bureaucratic bullshit. Yeah. Yeah. So I think Silence of the Lambs was a happy experience for, I mean, look, Harris had like a whole, when he stole the book rights, he had a clause in his contract that, like, if the book went up to the bestseller list, he got like an extra like 10 grand a week every week. So, I mean, financially, Silence of the Lambs was very good for him. Like, he was doing fine, but, like, don't forget that. But, you know, I don't put a lot of them in the book because I consider them kind of mostly private conversations, but it's very clear going through John and Demi's archives that Harris kept in touch with him in the 90s just for pure social reasons. I think they met up a couple times. Harris would fax over restaurant recommendations, like in France and stuff like that. And it's interesting to me because they seem, they're just so different. Like, one is kind of this, you know, quiet, you know, again, Southern small town guy, very soft spoken, kind of likes to be on his own. It seems like that's Tom Harris. And then John and Demi was like, this was like a total people person who was like, loved to collaborate, loved to work with people, loved to tell stories about people. You know, even the worst characters in his movies are human in whatever reason. And is kind of, was also like kind of a classic, kind of became a classic New York filmmaker at a certain point, you know, and was a Hollywood guy who made mainstream big blockbuster films for big studios at a certain point. They seem to be very different, but I think they were also both genuinely thoughtful, like, intellectuals. I'm using Tom Harris in the past tense only because Demi has passed away. So I think there was some sort of connection there. And yeah, I think Demi and Ted Talley saw something in The Silence of the Lambs that Harris, that made Harris happy in a way that Manhunter did not work for him. You know, and I it probably hurt when John and Demi didn't want to make the Hannibal film. I'm sure that hurt, but I even found a fax at one point from Demi saying, hey, I'm going to be first in line to see Hannibal this weekend. Like, they kept the relationship going, even afterward, it seems like.
Yeah. Because of how precious and deliberate he was as an author, I don't take any offense as an author who's like very precious. Cause like Silence of the Lambs, for everything that it is incredibly faithful adaptation, faithful.
Yeah.
And the original Manhunter, like Michael Mann had his own proclivities about like not showing so much of the life of Francis Dolehide and it being implied.
Yeah.
And being more influenced by other serial killers because he'd done his own kind of like John Douglas retcon. So had another set of influences that were very unique to Francis Dolehide that differ from the novel. And the ending, the man's original ending for Manhunter, which is only in the director's cut, which I'm not sure if you've had a chance to see, is...
Oh, where he goes to the house at the
end?
Is
Will,
that where he,
yeah, yes, Will yeah. Graham, yeah, Will Graham goes to the house at the end. And it kind of like hints at a lot of the stuff that Manhunter is really trying to get at. And so I can totally see why Thomas Harris wouldn't like it. However, after having read Red Dragon so much of Manhunter is so faithful to the novel. Like,
I wonder if Tom Harris would ever. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if Tom Harris has ever revisited the movie and how he would feel about it decades later. And I wonder, I mean, I'd be curious if Tom Harris is even aware of how big Manhunter has become. I mean, yeah. You'll appreciate this as the biggest Manhunter fan I know, but you know, I had first thought of a Silence of the Lambs book in like, I looked at the email recently in like February 2020, and then COVID happened. And I apparently just forgot about it. And then my agent, my editor, and I, we had separate conversations. Like, is there a book about Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter? And then, so in the fall, I think of 2023, out here in Los Angeles, there was a 70mm screening. Yes. There was a screening of Manhunter with Michael Mann. And you know this, I know this is LA. What, the tickets went on sale at 10 a.m. I was online at 9:59. I got one. They were gone at 10:01. You know, it's a huge event. And when we got there, I just assumed that like everyone here is just kind of like someone who has seen this movie a gazillion times. And then they did a show of hands, like, how many of you are seeing Manhunter for the first time? And like, I honestly, like, half the crowd went up of like really, really like young movie fans. And I was like, wow, like there is a fascination with this movie and Hannibal Lecter and Michael Mann. And I think the next week is when I was kind of like, I think this book is a good idea. Like, I think I had Manhunter had always been a movie that me and my friends liked. So I think I've kind of been slow to realize how big it's gotten in the last couple of years. Like, I mean, I was aware of it becoming a kind of a seminal film as Michael Mann's profile kind of became bigger with young moviegoers. But damn, it's like, there's some people, I mean, I did an interview this morning with a very young interviewer who was like, I like Silence of the Lambs, but Manhunter is my thing. And I was like, wow, there's a lot of them, you know? Wow.
And as a gigantic fan of Manhunter, I'm like, yeah, they're very different. And this is what has been lucky, you know, and I think in your book, you're kinder, because you have to be, but I don't have to be. I can say this, when you look at the four main feature films about Hannibal Lecter, that core story before it's the Hannibal Rising prequels, you have Michael Mann, Jonathan Demme, mm-hmm. Ridley Scott, and Brett Ratner.
Yeah.
One of these things is not like the others. And even when you're Brett Ratner and you have Ted Talley, Dante Scarnotti, yeah. like Anthony Hopkins, Norton, Keitel, like Philip Seymour Hoffman, diabolical that movie is. I'm sorry. Like, I mean, I'm good for Anthony Hopkins. I think that's one of the worst crimes to cinema of all time. Ralph Fiennes. It does not have many redeeming qualities for me as a movie, because I just think it takes something that is so punchy, atmospheric, completely on the button, like to the letter perfect, that as a novel, and then Manhunter, which I think does such a much more Michael Mann behavioral science,
right.
interior, you know, perspectives, and just make something that looks as drab and boring as like the worst Netflix show you've ever seen with the best.
Well, I mean, I don't look at it as unkindly as you do. I do not think it's a particularly great movie. I do have a fondness for it, A, because of the cast, B, because there is something in those early 2000s big studio movies before everything went all digital.
Yes, yes.
That works for me. And also, like, as someone now who has become so frustrated with the way special effects are handled, I love watching that big house, that actual set blow up. Like, I love stuff like that. There is some great stuff that, like, before everything went, when, you know, it came out at a time when CGI was mostly used for fantasy and sci-fi. And now it's used, you said, for everything. Everything's green screen. But, like, there is a real texture of that movie that I do appreciate. I don't think it entirely works, but I also, I do think there is something valid to the ending of the book. And I do think Ratner, to his credit, I can't believe giving Brett Ratner credit, but he was trying to stick to the original book. And Ratner in his interviews is like, I know I'm not Jonathan Demme. Like, Ratner, like, really seemed to be genuinely insecure about his own hiring on this movie. It would not be in my top Hannibal movie. And I like Manhunter a lot more, but I think they're interesting. Like, what I think is interesting is, like, if someone were to read the book and watch those two movies kind of in the same weekend, I'd be really curious to see what sticks out. And with it, because Michael Mann takes tons of liberties. Like, there's, you know, it's like, not just the ending. I mean, in terms of, as you said, it's like basically deleting Francis Dolarhyde's backstory, which is a huge part of the Red Dragon novel and a really compelling, an interesting part. So I, I, I'm interested in arguments about all of these different interpretations, and I think they prove the bigger point, which is like Lecter is a character that can be played by various actors and can be redone and reshaped and reimagined, because I think partly because he's just such a minimal part of these stories. So, you know, look, Red Dragon's been made now three times because the NBC series did it too at the end. You know, they brought that character in too. So that story is like, is, I hate to say timeless because it's cliche, but like it is pretty much a classic Predator and Prey kind of story that you could redo every 20 years or so, and it would still at least... there'd be new ideas to put into it. I'd be interested in a lot of different artists' take on that particular story, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think that when you look at, if there's one thing that can be said about the Mann novel, he gets how important Hannibal Lecter is from the jump. Like the that exchange, which is like near word perfect in from the novel into Manhunter, of like, you had disadvantages. What disadvantages? You're insane. Like, just like he knows that he's revealing, you know, especially Cox face to the wall, not talking to him. He knows how big Hannibal Lecter looms in the book, which is weird for the critics at the time to be like, yeah, like he's part of it. And it's like, no, the guy who's catching the bad guy is consulting with a man named Hannibal the Cannibal.
Like, I know.
It's like, it's pretty big, and Harris knows how big it is, and clearly then it evolves, but you know,
he's
a big
yeah.
character. But I love that section. And I do actually love, in the same way that Harris insisted in his novel, and in the same way that Demi understood innately with Hopkins, I do really love that in some of those great castings, whether it's Cox or whether it's Hopkins or later with Mads, particularly because Mads is one of my favorite actors working with Mads Mikkelsen. I loved that series because I loved his elliptical calm. Like he's just, he's so hard to put your finger on. And that's like the most disconcerting introduction to a character ever is in Silence of the Lambs when he walks up and he's standing completely still in the middle of the Think of Morning. You know, it's just like that is so iconic. And I feel like Mads like took a lot of that energy, even though he's doing awful, disgusting, artistic things with bodies and killing and manipulating Will Graham and doing all the things that he does in that series, which is so brilliant and fun and twisted. I really love his portrayal as Hannibal too. Like, I think that that's a really iconic performance, and clearly the fans of the show are out there.
The Fannibals are everywhere, but that show is fascinating because, like, what a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to take an incredibly grisly, well-known story with a well-known actor and make it an NBC show. Like, who was, and at the time, NBC was like, I mean, I think The Apprentice was on. Like, NBC at that time when it came out seemed to really be kind of like, all right, we've got a Betty White game show. We've got The Apprentice. Like, it's like, what the hell was NBC or network TV at that point? And what's really fascinating about the Hannibal NBC show, I mean, the two things are really interesting. One, as you mentioned, like the Mikkelsen performance, and obviously for an actor to take on a role that Anthony Hopkins did, you have to do something totally different. But if you make it too different, it's just going to feel like a gimmick. So for him to play, I think a warm, a genuinely interested, a kind of like almost he's playing Hannibal Lecter, almost as a journalist who wants to investigate how humans work and think and kind of, like, yes, he's interested in crime, but he does seem like he's actually trying to understand how the human mind works.
He's like Jane Goodall in that show. He's like, look at all these apes. Look, aren't they interesting? Yeah, he's got this like curiosity. Yeah.
Except he's like, well, what do they taste like too? Like, I don't think Jane Goodall was that interested in pulling out the back of someone's spine or whatever, making it wings or whatever the hell he does. So the performance is really interesting in making Hannibal as kind of this insider outsider. But also what I think is really great about that show, and Harris has had this twice now, where Harris has had an incredibly tough to adapt work handled by an incredibly skillful writer. I mean, Ted Talley, as you mentioned, that Silence of the Lambs adaptation, that is still taught. I mean, that is like a 35-year-old movie. That is still taught as like how to take a novel that everyone knows and make a screenplay. And it's a perfect adaptation. And I think the same way, Brian Fuller, when he was in, he was the creator of the show, and there were other writers in the show, obviously, what that writing team did with the Hannibal NBC series is they managed to somehow take all these granular elements from across the three books they had the rights to, which were, you know, Red Dragon and Hannibal and Hannibal and Hannibal Rising. And they made, they took all these elements, characters, little narratives, they threw them all together and they felt very true to what Harris was writing. But at the same time, that is 100% through Brian Fuller's vision, in the same way that Manhunter is 100%, you know, a Michael Mann movie. Hannibal is very much a Brian Fuller show, like the flourishes, the visuals.
No one could have done Demi's POV. The Demi POV is something that is also taught.
Like, absolutely, yeah. And I think that's why people love the Hannibal show too. Is like, I think they were at that point, people were either skeptical of another Hannibal Lecter thing or just kind of bored with the character. And that show proved that this character could be reinvented again. And I think, you know, I've been having a lot of conversations about the book in the last couple of weeks, and I've been asked a couple of times, well, don't you think that it's going to remake another Hannibal Lecter story and kind of like Hollywood, just it's going to be another kind of IP? And it's like, I'm sure they will. There's still some complicated rights issues, but I actually don't take offense at the idea that there could be a new Hannibal Lecter every 10 years. I do think it's kind of a flexible character. You could take him, play him so many different ways, as long as it's someone with an actual vision for what that would be different than the other versions of Hannibal we've had. So they'll inevitably announce another Silence of the Lambs, or, you know, maybe they'll even do Red Dragon again at some point. And I think everyone will kind of groan as they do on the internet. But if it's someone with a vision, that could be kind of cool. Like, I actually think you can do this a couple times and not make it feel exhausting.
Yeah, I was a person who have, like, I've loved in, and as much as Hannibal the novel, like, I love how different my three favorite, you know, adaptations of those three core novels are. Like, Manhunter is a Michael Mann's interpretation, and Demi and Tally, despite its faithfulness, has such a unique vision and POV that is just unbelievable, and atmosphere, and the Takfa Kajima, like, cinematography is just, forget it. Like, it's incredible.
It's a great looking movie.
It's unbelievable looking. And Ridley Scott's is this lurid, like, you know, vulgar auteur kind of like Anthony Hopkins is like Universal movie monster Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
And I like it. Like, I have a lot of time for that movie. I watched it many times when we were doing the Manhunter project here on One Heat Minute Productions. It was like, when we were doing Manhunter, I was like, I watched it and I was like, yeah, this is fun. I of course watched Silence of the Lambs. But I watched that and I'm like, yeah, this is Ridley just going for it. Like, he's just doing his thing. And is it different? Is it as good as Silence of the Lambs? You know, probably not. But I think they all have that unique thing. And that's what was so unique about the show, is the show had such this vivid fever dream vision that literally took like paragraphs from Red Dragon and elaborated that into, like, you know, this Shrike, the Shrike sort of serial killer who is like, in the show is like framed, and it's actually Lecter who's the Shrike, like the Minister of Shrike. And so I thought it was really clever to take those tendrils and, as you said, sort of fuse them together and still feel like its own thing. And, you know, that I keep seeing this article, these articles pop up, and maybe it was around your book, is like, Fuller's dream still to this day is at some point to like get all those people who are back together from his show and do a Silence of the Lambs as a season, like as one big epic season. And he keeps saying, I want Mads to be Hannibal Lecter, and I want Zendaya to be Clarice.
Yeah, he told me Zendaya too, like a year ago when I talked to him. He's definitely been thinking about this for a while. Yeah.
He's like, that's the one that I want to do. And like having Clarice meet Will in some capacity, broken, you know, broken Will Graham, that we never really see between Silence and Red Dragon, because obviously at the end of the novel, like, Will's completely messed up. But yeah, I think that's a very interesting thing that is always like teased, but we'll never know if it's going to actually happen until I think you and I hear about it, that it's actually happening.
I think Clarice is the harder character to read, to, because I just think it's like they tried it with Julianne Moore, who's a fantastic actor, and it didn't quite work at times in the movie, or people just couldn't see it for whatever reason. Clarice is tough because Foster's performance, like, there's just so much vulnerability. And I think whereas you can read Hannibal as a character a million different ways, if you look at the books or the scripts, I think Clarice is such a fully formed human character, and that performance captures all that. that it's tough. I mean, I don't know what young actor would want to play Clarice. I mean, it's like, I mean, eventually, you know, even Vince Vaughn wanted to play Norman Bates, and so you can convince an actor to do this, but Clarice is, that's a really big ask of someone who has to be a young 20-something performer to take on a kind of a legacy and the expectations that big. Though Zendaya is pretty great, so I mean, I'm sure she could do it.
Yeah, she could definitely do it. It's just a really tough, it's tough to be that vulnerable and good.
Yeah.
Because,
oh, yeah.
You know, the great thing about Clarice is that even when she's kicking down Buffalo Bill's door, she's still in such peril.
Oh, yeah.
And what's so cool is that she goes in anyway. That's part of her inherent bravery and what's awesome. And it's like throughout this whole thing, she's behind a step. She's clever, but she's a step behind.
Yeah.
And she gets it. And it's like, that's a really like, to modulate that performance so perfectly, like throughout, to just be like, I'm always one step behind, but I'm not silly. I just like, I'm talking to psychopathic geniuses giving me information and I'm trying to interrogate their riddles. But yeah, that I agree with you. Like every time someone's like, you could get a cool Lecter, there are plenty of fantastic actors that I think of, but Clarice is like incredibly hard. One that popped into my head was just like, you need like kind of someone as innocent as like a Zoe Deutsch. Like someone like that. I don't know if Zoe Deutsch is like, but recently saw her in Nouvelle Vague and I was like, oh, she's brilliant as Jean Seberg, and saw her in, you know, recently in Everybody Wants Some and things like that. Great actor. Yeah. But it's like, you know, Jodie Foster's like, she's pretty much one of the best actors that's ever lived. It's pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And she plays that particular kind of character at that point in her life very well. She was very, very dogged about taking that role, about convincing Demi that she was the right fit for it, which is a whole kind of wild thing where you're like, you know, the Demi was not entirely sold on her, which is, you know, just proof that even the best artists can make bad decisions at times and have bad instincts, you know? But I think what you're saying about Clarice, and I think the reason why she's so beloved, I actually just finished an essay for the Boston Globe that's going to come out about Clarice and about the impact she kind of had as a character. Because to me, she's just as important as Lecter in these stories.
Definitely.
You know, even when she, and this is in the book, but it's especially in the movie, is that even when she's fearless, she's kind of terrified, which is the most relatable human condition, is that for all of our talk about being bold and being brave and you got this and don't worry, you know, it's like, and show no fear. It's like, we are always afraid when we're doing something that should be scared. Well, we should be afraid. It's just a matter of how we incorporate that and absorb it and use that fear to propel us or to push us back. And it's one of the great, you know, her going down to, I don't want to spoil the Silence of the Lambs or people, but you know, her going down.
Oh, sorry. Are you spoiling like one of the greatest pieces of cinema ever made?
I know,
and
yeah,
won the
sorry.
Most Academy Awards. How dare you? How dare you, like 30 years ago.
When people talk about their favorite scenes, yes, like the escape from that crazy jail cell, like the back and forth between, but man, really the scene where she's standing outside, like inside Buffalo Bill's house, and she sees that moth fluttering, and you know that she knows what has to happen and how terrifying that's going to be. You know, it's great. And I think in the book, there's just one line about Clarice going down to the basement, how terrified she is. Like, I can't remember how he coins it, but it's that fear, look of fear on her face, expertly captures how it is in the book and how all of us would be, even if we were the bravest person, you know?
Yeah, like, you and I are much taller, bigger guys than little tiny Clarice Starling. Guess where the last place on planet Earth I want to be going?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even
I don't like going to basements. Yeah. I don't like going to basements that I know there's not a serial killer down there. I'm very clumsy. And I'm getting that age now where a fall could really take me out. But yeah, like, you know,
it's like
much less without backup.
You and I have watched Zodiac and Silence of the Lambs too many times. It's like
the two greatest basement scenes of all time. Really? Night of the Living Dead is number up there too. Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to go into basements in the dark. I don't. And in Australia, there's not like, we Australians don't do basements. We just don't do them. Like there's a particular town in sort of central Australia called Coober Pedy, like it's out in the desert, like sort of as you get past our mountains and things like that, where it's so hot that a lot of the houses are built underground. They're dug into the rock. Like,
oh wow.
So it's a really interesting and cool place, like mining town, opal mines, things like that. And so I imagine going to Coober Pedy, like happily taking the solace of going into an underground, like little home and having a cup of tea there and staying there for a night is like a kind of like, you know, Airbnb This is not an advert, but maybe like a curio like experience holiday. You couldn't get me in a dark basement like Buffalo.
Yeah.
I just don't want any part of it. I'm okay. Thank you very much for asking. I'm good. I just don't need it in my life.
Yeah, I'm with
but
you.
You know what you do need in your life? This book. Brian, this is really this is really brilliant. Hannibal Lecter Alive. Brian is such a talent.
I encourage you to listen
to his podcast. I encourage you to buy this book. Again, I wasn't joking. Like I did the, you know, Thomas Harris novels are the perfect plain novels. Like people used to, you know, that's why they populated plain bookstores. I actually went on like a recent interstate trip and it's only, I think it's about an hour and a half flight each way. And your book was done about halfway through the return journey because it was only
I'm glad. Well, thank you.
And I so voraciously consumed it. It's so beautifully researched and well thought out. And it has such brilliant insights into like one of our dominant pop cultural themes of like true crime and obsession with serial killers. And I think so much of it, you help chart that and really talk about how that fear that, you know, and anxiety about crime and killers that King talked about really metastasized then and has just sort of like almost like become its own unique thing since Silence. And I just loved reading about Harris, this elusive guy, this aspirational, you know, author who puts out, you know, five books and or six books in his entire life and just lives.
He lives.
Restaurants in Tuscany and painting and auditing criminal behavioral science classes and then going to Paris and learning how to cook. And it's just like
quite a life.
What a life. What a fascinating life. And what a fascinating life for this character, which I don't think is over. So yeah, man, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate the time. And
Thank you.
I hope so many people get their hands on this because it's a really, really fun read. And
thank you.
And everyone who is listening to our show, the Minsider, there's some really great, the Min Hunter. There's some really great, like Red Dragon through Man Hunter and all of the beautiful Dino De Laurentiis of it all
Dino stuff that the stuff I didn't have room to include. Oh my God. I'm so, if I could go back in time, Dino De Laurentiis's North Carolina movie studio he built in the 80s. I'm like, I wish I could live that. He basically staffed with a lot of Italians he brought over some of them couldn't speak English. Like, I'm just like, that is, I want to live on that soundstage. I want to live on that entire complex for like 2 weeks. Can I imagine?
I read your book and I read like around the same time I got like a Christmas gift, which I finally got around to reading Abel Ferrara's Scene. And so I read all your Dino stuff.
Same editor. My editor edited that book.
Oh, fantastic. So in Abel's book, talks about Dino having built a gigantic water tank in, I think, some like North African country, might be like Tunisia or something. He built for Orca, and he was kept trying to convince people who were trying to make like gritty New York crime movies to go and shoot in the water in Tunisia. And they're like, what am I shooting a crime movie in a tank in Tunisia, Abel? You know, Dino, what am I doing? Dino De Laurentiis is a fascinating character. And your stuff in there, I don't want to spoil that because, you know, but there's so many gems in this book for you to discover. I think it's really brilliantly researched and illuminating, man. So you've done a great job, and as you always do, but thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Absolutely. Thank you. I really appreciate it, man.